Roger Williams University is hosting a crisis management seminar on May 3rd at their Providence campus. Crises, whether a natural disaster, cyber attack, or financial instability, can have severe repercussions if not handled properly. This is where crisis management plays a pivotal role. Join Roger Williams MBA students and expert speakers to learn how to prepare for the unexpected. The program is totally free and open to the public. You can register online at rwu.edu/events/crisis-management-symposium.
Support the Bartholomew Town Podcast by subscribing, rating, and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Welcome to another edition of the Bartholomew Town Podcast. I'm your host, Bill Bartholomew. On today's episode, I sit down with the executive director of Roger Williams Park Zoo, Dr. Jeremy Goodman. Providence's Roger Williams Park Zoo has consistently been recognized as a leading zoological institution, as well as a regional tourism magnet. But with increased scrutiny being placed on animal captivity, I sat down with Roger Williams Executive Director, Dr. Goodman, for a wide-ranging conversation about his operations conservation, rehabilitation, and educational work, as well as the role that the zoo serves in the Rhode Island community. Of course, I also asked Dr. Goodman about the broad ethics of zoos and animal captivity. Hey, I've got a brand new episode of the pod for you every Tuesday and Friday. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or visit BartholomewTown.com or RIPodcast.com. Let's get to it, talking all things zoos. We'll go straight to the source. All right, we are here with Dr. Jeremy Goodman of Roger Williams Park Zoo, and an institution in Rhode Island for sure, some place that I used to go as a little kid all the time. We had a membership, the aquarium and zoo membership type of deal. If you could just give us a little bit of background on kind of your own journey in zoology and how you've landed as the executive director.
Sure. So my background is actually in veterinary medicine. I have a doctorate in veterinary medicine from Tufts. I went to undergrad at Rutgers in animal science major. I got my bachelor's there. But ever since I was a little kid, all I ever wanted to do was run a zoo. I was always just fascinated with zoos and animals and how important zoos are to the community as far as their role and their mission for education and conserving animals and being a great place for recreation where you can spend quality family time together. So it's something that I've always wanted to do since I was a little kid, and I'm living the dream right now. I started doing veterinary work in private practice and moved over. I got my first zoo job in South Bend, Indiana at the Pottawatomie Zoo, and then moved to the Turtleback Zoo in New Jersey, where I was there for 10 years and rebuilt that zoo and got them to be nationally accredited by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. And then I landed here in Rhode Island. I was recruited, and we have a fantastic zoo here, a historic zoo, the third oldest in the country. And we have a national reputation for our conservation programs and our education programs. So very, very happy to be here, and I've been here almost 6 years now, and looking forward to more great things.
So what's the major initiative that the zoo is involved in? Would you say it's more on the conservation side? Is it more on the educational side? How do you balance all of that?
So it is a balance. We're the number one tourist attraction, paid tourist attraction in the state. So we have the recreation arm. We do a lot of conservation work. So we definitely have that arm, and we do a lot of education work. So it is a balancing act because all three are very important. If people weren't having a good time, they wouldn't want to come. Which their attendance fees support our conservation work and our animal care. So it is a balancing act. Why we're here is all about the animals and connecting people to wildlife and wild places, just really fostering that connection, educating people on the plight of animals and nature. So they all three are actually very much interconnected. I do rounds throughout the zoo grounds on a daily basis, and you don't have to walk very far to see just – kids of all ages, and that includes adults, just being inspired, by the animals that we care for, and you can definitely see that connection, and it's something that you just don't get by watching Animal Planet or some sort of educational DVDs, things like that. Those are nice supplements, but when you're actually at our zoo and you're feeding a giraffe and that 18-inch tongue comes and wraps around the leaf and pulls it right out of your hand, that is a profound moment. And that is a moment where the little light bulb goes on. And we see it every single day where, wow, these animals are amazing. And I can't even imagine a world and don't want to imagine a world where they're disappearing and they're not going to be here for future generations, which unfortunately is the case right now. So it's something that we do see that kind of inspiration every single day.
That sort of feeds into my next question, I guess, broadly with regards to zoo ethics. I mean, we've seen such a change in terms of circuses and just the presentation in general has shifted in my lifetime for sure, as far as some zoos have shut down, some circuses have changed their practices and so on and so forth. Do you feel like the cost benefit of humans interacting with these animals to understand them at an intangible level ultimately allows for humankind to hopefully treat the nature with more respect and in that sense preserve wildlife?
Well, I think, the ethics of zoos, really shouldn't be much of a question. I think it really should be, the question needs to be the welfare of the animals in the zoo. I don't see how conserving animals and educating people is an ethical question. That's what we do. The question really should be, are we taking proper care of these animals? And if we are, and they're getting proper veterinary care, they're being mentally stimulated with proper enrichment programs, all their needs are being met, then there really is no ethical question. If that's not the case and the animals are in substandard conditions, then yes, there is an issue with that, and those types of places, really shouldn't exist, or they need to step up their game and improve. Our zoo has been accredited by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums for over a quarter century. They are the gold standard. There's over 2,000 zoos in this country, believe it or not, that are accredited by the USDA. They're the governing agency who oversees zoos for the government. But less than 10% of those meet the really high standards of the AZA. So we've been doing that from the very beginning. This year, we also voluntarily had an audit from the American Humane Association. They're the same organization that you see in the movies, No Animals Were Harmed in This Movie and whatnot. And we brought them out on our own time to do a full audit to make sure that we were providing good welfare for our animals. So it's something that the bar is always raising, and we're up for that challenge, that we want to make sure that we are, taking the best possible care of our animals, and not just on an emotional level, but on a scientific level, that we can back that up. Not just saying, oh, I don't think they're happy, but, looking at real science, whether it's, fecal stress hormones or things along those lines, to really understand, how these animals are doing and hopefully thriving in our care. And if they're not, then we need to change.
Do you feel like you've, in your time, have been able to kind of access that level of consciousness within animals just on an intangible level? Again, sort of, there's no way to know what a creature's feeling, but do you feel like you have maybe a way to access that feeling somehow, whether it's, not necessarily purely scientific, but you just know whether or not things are right or wrong?
So there is a science to it, believe it or not, and our keepers are so in tune with our animals. I'll tell you a story. One of the things I remembered in veterinary school, I actually came in and we visited Roger Williams Park Zoo, and in their hospital, they were caring for a sloth who was lethargic. Now, you have to be really in tune with your animal to be able to pick up a sloth who is lethargic. And our keepers are professionals, and they are very much in tune with their needs and how they're feeling and things along those lines. you know, trying to project human emotions onto animals is kind of a very tricky and dangerous thing to do. Like I said, you know, we work with a variety of professionals, behaviorists, veterinarians, animal care professionals, animal welfare professionals that, you know, really understand, you know, the types of things to look for as far as, you know, behavior changes and the things that signal a healthy and thriving animal. So that's really, you know, what we focus on. You know, the people who, you know, come and visit and see an animal sleeping and, you know, claim that it's bored, I've got news for you. That's what animals do. You know, a lion in the wild sleeps almost 23 hours a day. So that's not boredom. That's just what animals do. And our animals aren't there to perform for people. So if they want to sleep under a tree in the shade, then that's what they do. And that's not a sign of boredom. That's just the freedom to choose what they want to do.
Any particular exhibits coming in 2019 that bring new animals or a new look at some sort of habitat to the community?
So we just opened our newest exhibit, Faces of the Rainforest, at the end of November of this year. So it essentially will be very new for 2019. And it's a phenomenal new exhibit. It's the largest single exhibit in the zoo's history. And we brought in dozens of new species, you know, for the exhibit. And that's something that I also want to emphasize. A lot of times zoo critics will say, oh, you're draining the wild, you know, from the animals. You know, we work with, I believe it was 40 different institutions to bring these animals in here. So they're all part of a collective cooperative breeding programs. We had put in requests for a lot of these animals to be bred for us from other zoos years in advance because it takes a lot of planning. So this new exhibit is really phenomenal. It's all about the South American rainforest, and it tells a great story. We use the storytelling method. There's an art installation in New York called Faces of New York, which a lot of the listeners might be familiar with. And it takes very relatable pictures and has, you know, these kind of small, once again, very relatable quotes. So we use that methodology to kind of tell the story of first the expected faces of the rainforest, and then we shift it to the unexpected faces of the rainforest, and then it shifts once again towards you and I being a face of the rainforest and how our everyday decisions, whether at the supermarket or at the coffee shop or, you know, when we're buying furniture, can actually have quite a significant impact on the rainforest. So I think this new exhibit is one of the first ones in our master plan where we have a significant call to action for our visitors who experience the exhibit to leave the exhibit knowing the difference that they can make and challenging them to make that difference.
I've spent a decent amount of time in South America. One major something that's really despised in Brazil anyway is bird trafficking, you know, capturing exotic birds for whatever and selling them off. So you're saying that a lot of these birds are that are in, I'm not even sure that there are birds in this exhibit, but assuming there are, they're actually bred in another zoo and you're just relocating them. They've never been in the wild.
That's correct. So, you know, I believe our caciques came from Seattle, our orapendulas came from California, from San Diego. All the birds came from other zoos. They weren't pulled from Brazil or anything like that. Yeah. The only animals, the one animal that I would like to mention actually that did come from the wild is an incredible conservation story, and that's some of our fish. We work very closely with a project called Project Piaba, which is in the Rio del Negro region of the Amazon. And the Amazon rises and ebbs, seasonally. And as the waters recede, there's all these little puddles of water that fish get trapped in that would otherwise die. And this project does is actually has the people, the natives of the area, collecting these fish for the pet fish trade. So these are fish that would have otherwise died. Now they're providing them with a living so they don't have to sell their land off to developers who are going to ranch it or mine it, you know, things that are very detrimental. They understand that for the fish to thrive, you can't take down the trees because then, you know, you have erosion and sediment that ruins the water and kills off the fish. So it encourages them to preserve their land even, you know, more so than they were already doing, and provides them with a living, a sustainable means, because the reproduction strategy of a lot of these fish are they reproduce by the millions in the Amazon. So removing, you know, handfuls of fish for the pet fish trade actually does no harm whatsoever to those populations, and yet helps preserve the forest. So yes, removing large parrots like macaws and whatnot out of the forest, very bad. But tropical fish like cardinal tetras and discus and things along those lines in a controlled, sustainable manner, very good. So a lot of times these are very complicated issues, and you can't just put a blanket statement of taking from the wild is bad, because sometimes if it's done in a sustainable way and actually helps the forest and helps the people maintain their lands as opposed to having to sell them off to developers can be a good thing. So sometimes these stories are very, very complicated, and it's very difficult to kind of try to just dumb them down.
Do you feel like the zoo has a good relationship with local DEM or anything of that nature? Do you have any sort of work that you do with our, you know, non-exotic animals, I guess?
Oh, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, we are, I would say we are the leader in New England for local conservation. We contribute to conservation work around the world on, you know, pretty much almost every continent. You know, we contribute to dozens and dozens of projects worldwide, but our focus is actually right here in our own backyard. I mean, you know, and our focus is also some of the species that aren't very glamorous: the American burying beetle, the timber rattlesnake, yeah. You know, the New England cottontail. You know, these are not you know, African elephants or giant pandas. These, but they still need our help. And our zoo is been a longtime leader in that field. And one of the things that our director of conservation, Lou Perotti, does so well is he's a connector, and he really helps facilitate all these state groups, whether it's Rhode Island DEM, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut. We work with, you know, all the New England states. We work with other zoos like the Queen Zoo, which is part of the Wildlife Conservation Society, on our rabbit breeding projects. So, you know, we facilitate, bring all these entities together, and we frequently house, you know, these meetings where all these different state agencies and federal agencies, as well as other, you know, private conservation organizations, come together to work together for a common goal, which is really, really important. So, yeah. Sometimes the exotic conservation stories get a lot of the press, but you know, we understand that conservation begins in our own backyard, and it's something that we're really proud of, working with some of those less charismatic species, because we think they are very charismatic, but less charismatic according to the general public. But and the other thing that we really try to do is we try to get people involved as well. We're involved with two citizen science projects that we one we head up, which is our Frog Watch program, which we teach people, just everyday people like you and me, that to identify frog calls, and then they enter that data, where they heard it, when they heard it, into a national database, and scientists can use all that data to track, you know, why certain frogs were in an area, why they're disappearing, where they're disappearing to, where they're popping up maybe. So it's a great project that teaches people, everyday people, how to get involved with real science. The other one that we're very involved with is we partner with the Rhode Island Natural History Survey, and we host the training for the annual BioBlitz. And that's another great citizen science program where you can go out and over a 24-hour period identify every single living thing within that study range. And they're both great experiences and great family activities as well. We have university scientists out there, hobbyists come join us, elementary school kids come out and experience it. So, you know, to answer your question, we do a lot locally.
Yeah, I love that term, citizen science, as well. I mean, that is beautiful. It really can take place on a daily basis. I grew up in Charlestown out in the woods and spent a lot of time hanging out with turtles. I'd collect, you know, I was really fascinated by turtles. I had a turtle farm for a few summers. My mom would always make me release them on the last day of summer into Warden's Pond or whatever. But
I've noticed over the last 15 years a lot less turtles. I haven't looked this hard, but just seems like there's less turtles. Seems like wild turkey populations have expanded. It just seems like things have shifted in South County. Is that, that's obviously anecdotal. Do you suspect there's any kind of scientific evidence to back up the idea that development has increased and now there's less frogs and turtles hanging out in Charlestown?
You know, it's hard to say, and that's why we really do need the science to be able to track that. And you know, one of our projects that we just started, I believe almost 2 years ago right now, is looking at wood turtles and their prevalence in the wild. Because if we don't know their numbers and we don't know their historic numbers, then it really is just pure conjecture on our part. So really getting that data, and if you really want to protect the species, then you need that data. You can't just say, I think they're disappearing, so therefore we should protect them. Usually doesn't fly very well with legislation and whatnot.
Right.
So it's something that we are very involved with, and things are changing. I mean, you know, certain populations are disappearing and other populations are increasing. So and there usually is a reason. One of the things that we love so much about that Frog Watch program is that, you know, frogs are certainly a sentinel species. They are the proverbial canaries in the coal mine, and because of their permeable skin, they are very sensitive to you know, environmental changes and you know, things like pesticides and toxins in the environment. So when frogs start disappearing, you know, that's a sign that there's more to come. So I do believe that your kind of anecdotal experience is probably right on the money.
Your relationship with state lawmakers, you were in the news recently on the bullhook issue. There must be more issues that you get involved with, you know, advocating for legislation to be passed or not passed and so on and so forth. What's that like for you, that your role as sort of a lobbyist, if you will?
Well, I think we're more of an educator than a lobbyist, quite honestly.
That's a bad word, I know, but
but, you know, it is important to us because, unfortunately, there are a lot of groups that have agendas out there, whether they're anti-zoo agendas or even if they mean well, you know, where they're just not accurate. And you know, and there's developers that have agendas as well. There's a lot of different competing interests. So what we really encourage all of our legislators to do is to use the zoo as a resource. We have experts in education, in the environment, in conservation, in animal welfare. So we really encourage legislators when there's legislation to pass, you know, in any of those areas, that to use this as a resource, and you know, because as we all know, the devil is really in the detail in a lot of these laws, and they can mean well, but if there's a single phrase that you know isn't worded properly, it can really, you know, either make it going from effective to non-effective, or it can have, you know, unintended consequences as well. So, you know, that's really where we see our role. I mean, we've certainly pushed and partnered with other organizations to try to pass an ivory bill in Rhode Island to outlaw the sale of ivory because, you know, elephants are being slaughtered on a regular basis. I mean, almost 100 a day are being slaughtered for their ivory, and you know, they're going to be disappearing.
Horrendous.
It is, and you know, it makes no sense to me, and why, you know, why we can't get this passed. But so we do try to pass certain pieces of legislation, and you know, and we are oftentimes fighting anti-zoo legislation as well. But you know, our big goal is really to educate the lawmakers and to partner with our other conservation partners to make sure that there's sound legislation for the environment and pro-conservation legislation in the state.
Absolutely. And on the ivory, you would think maybe that's the Scrimshaw lobby in Newport. You know, those are hundreds of thousands, if not million-dollar businesses that they're selling whale bone and tusks to people, you know, on the street. So if you're out there, maybe don't buy that.
Right. You know, I mean, that's all we can really encourage people is that if there's no demand for it, you know, then that's the biggest help. So hopefully we can get some of these anti, ivory laws in place. But in the meantime, certainly, you know, do due diligence and ask if there's any ivory in the product that you're looking to buy. And if there is, then just I would avoid it.
And the zoo's open now, even though it's cold. It's wide open. Come on out.
Yeah, the zoo's open. We're open year round, and winter's one of my four favorite seasons to come to the zoo. So a lot of our animals are more active in the winter. Our snow leopards, our red pandas, our bison. In the heat of the summer, oftentimes they're sleeping in in a cool area, but now they're very active this time of year, and we're open. Everything's on our website, rwpzoo.org, and I think one of the other things that, if I kind of had a last parting statement, is people don't realize that the zoo is actually a not-for-profit. We're like I said, a conservation education organization. Our ticket fees only cover part of the work we do. So, we're really working hard, to raise money so we can, get it out there and do all the great things that we do. So, it's something that I think a lot of people remember the old days when it used to be a city entity. The zoo is still owned by the city, but the Rhode Island Zoological Society has been managing it for a number of years now, and it's one of those things that we really do rely on people's support, to make all these great things happen.
And of course, just keeping the brand alive as well. I mean, it's a legacy brand in Rhode Island. There's less and less of those for even on the commercial side. Benny's and the Paw Sox are gone, but the zoo, that's thriving and growing in your mind?
It is. We're coming up on our 150th anniversary, and we're really excited. We're going to be planning a whole year's long worth of events. That's in 2022, but we're already planning it. And, it's one of those things when we talk about, kind of Rhode Island landmarks, the zoo is the home of the Sentinel dog. And, I don't think there's a single family in Rhode Island that doesn't have their picture on that dog statue, and we have some people that come, and that's their holiday card every single year, and I think the zoo is something that is a Rhode Island tradition, and is something that Rhode Islanders really should be proud of, and it's a great asset for the state, and like I said, we just have plans to just make sure that it stays relevant and that we keep getting better, and that we fulfill our mission of conservation, education, and animal care.
Thank you, Doctor. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
It's always great to spend time together, and I look forward to our next podcast episode coming your way on Tuesday. You can also stay up to date with all of my latest content on Instagram at Bartholomew Town Podcast. Until next time, I'm Bill Bartholomew. We'll talk soon. Discover the dozens of conversations I've had on the Bartholomew Town podcast with Rhode Island politicians, media members, artists, and beyond at bartholomewtown.com, ripodcast.com, or on Apple Podcasts.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits, and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.